Hello, I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. On this special extended edition of All Things Political, we're talking about the Democratic National Convention, which is kicking off today in Philadelphia. While hopes were for unity and momentum, leaked emails showing a concerted effort to sabotage the Sanders campaign by the DNC leadership and the outrage of Bernie Sanders supporters is casting that in doubt. Joining us now from the convention is WPR's Capitol Bureau Chief, Sean Johnson. Sean, good to talk with you.
Good to talk with you, Judith.
So, you were in Cleveland last week, Philadelphia this week. What is your sense of how the 2 weeks may differ?
You know, I guess you're struck by some of the similarities, actually. You spent all last week hearing from Republican leaders telling Republicans who were on the fence, who maybe didn't like Donald Trump going into the convention, that, look, you got to support Donald Trump. If you stay home or if you vote third party, it's as good as voting for Hillary Clinton. And essentially, Republicans were using Hillary Clinton as their get-out-the-vote machine, as their unifier. And the Republican message in Cleveland. You're already hearing some of the same with the names switched here in Philadelphia, where Sanders people are not convinced that they want to vote for Hillary Clinton, some of them. The latest email scandal certainly doesn't help that. And you're hearing Democrats say, look, don't think that you can protest and stay home, or that that voting third party is an option here. Doing that is as good as supporting Donald Trump. And essentially they're using Donald Trump as a unifying factor, saying that ought to scare you into making sure that we have a unified Democratic Party heading into November.
And you mentioned the email scandal, Sean, and that came up in the last hour as well. But can you give us a little more detail on what exactly came out via that WikiLeaks announcement?
Well, it was 20,000 emails that came out, and the ones that have caught Sanders supporters' attention are those which show the DNC under Debbie Wasserman Schultz actively working to undermine Sanders. And, you know, just to frame that a little bit, it seemed like during the primary campaign, Sanders supporters kind of, there was an inclination among many of them to say, look, the powers that be are out to get us, right? Mm-hmm. And that the DNC is working against us. And the DNC would come out and essentially say, you know, we're being an umpire here, right? We're not supporting any candidate formally. These emails come out and show, in fact, they were working behind the scenes on behalf of Hillary Clinton against Bernie Sanders. And so the timing really for Democrats couldn't be worse heading into their convention. I suppose it could be better that it's coming out now and not closer to the election. But it's not in a week when they want to unify, not exactly the kind of message that they can rally around on day one.
And what's on the agenda for day one? What is going to be the kickoff for the convention?
Yeah, you've got some pretty big speakers tonight, among them Bernie Sanders. And I mean, what he says in his convention speech, and also when they do the formal roll call tomorrow, when the delegates actually cast their ballots tomorrow. And what Bernie Sanders says in those two instances could go a long way toward unifying a party that's a bit fractured right now. You have Michelle Obama, who's an extremely popular figure among Democrats, is going to speak tonight. You have Elizabeth Warren, who is a favorite of the party base, is going to speak tonight. So those speakers could go a long way toward kind of patching up some pretty serious hurt feelings right now in Philadelphia.
On the NPR news break a little earlier, we heard Bernie Sanders addressing those protesters outside of the convention who are still saying Bernie or bust and lock her up about Hillary Clinton. He said it's crucial for everyone to vote for the Clinton-Kane ticket. And actually, there were boos from his own supporters. So if Bernie Sanders can't convince them, what's it going to take?
I don't know. One thing you'll hear from Bernie Sanders supporters is that this is a movement, that this campaign is bigger than him, that it's not about Bernie Sanders. It's about the ideas that his campaign is built around. If that's the case, and they feel like Bernie has left the movement when he endorses Hillary Clinton, what do you say? I mean, there are some Bernie Sanders supporters who will not support Hillary Clinton. And just being out here and wearing a media badge, I've had a couple come up from other state delegations, not from Wisconsin, a couple come up and say, hey, you want to talk to me? I'm not going to support Hillary Clinton. So that's just a couple anecdotal examples. Mm-hmm. And I think if you look at polling, I think you're going to find a lot of Bernie Sanders supporters are going to support Hillary Clinton, that they'll ultimately support the Democratic candidate as we get closer to Election Day. But that just to point out that that sentiment does exist out here, in that part of the reason is that Sanders supporters feel like, you know, it's bigger than him.
We're talking right now with WPR's Capital Bureau Chief Sean Johnson. He is on the ground in Philadelphia for the Democratic National Convention. And Sean, you were also on the ground in Cleveland last week for the GOP convention, and you were very busy because Wisconsin had a pretty prominent role to play with a lot of major party leaders and also speakers, spending time with the Wisconsin delegation. Do you expect Wisconsin to have as high a profile this week with the Democrats?
It will not. No, we do not compare on a national level to the Wisconsin connections to the Republican Party. I mean, on the Republican side for Wisconsin, you have, first of all, you have Chairman Reince Priebus of the Republican National Committee, who basically ran the convention. He was there. Paul Ryan was the formal chair of the convention. You have Scott Walker, a prominent governor and a former presidential candidate, was there. Ron Johnson, who spoke. Sheriff David Clark, who maybe as prominent nationally or more prominent nationally than he is here in Wisconsin, because he's an outspoken kind of Fox News personality on gun issues. So you had all that at the Republican convention in Cleveland. In Philadelphia, you will have a couple Democrats speaking. Tammy Baldwin will take the stage at the Democratic National Convention, and Congresswoman Gwen Moore will take the stage and speak at the Democratic National Convention. So not as large of a speaking presence, but you will have a couple Wisconsin, Wisconsinites represented here.
Well, and I understand also, Sean, that Maria Hamilton, who is the mother of Dontre Hamilton, who was a Milwaukee man who was killed by police, she will also be speaking. Do you have a sense of what her message will be?
I'd have to go back. I know our colleague Chuck Kornbach did a story on that a little while back, as to what she was going to say. So I don't know what she's going to talk about at the convention, but you will, of course, hear a different message here than you did at the Republican convention, when the attitude toward, you know, for example, the Black Lives Matter movement was pretty scornful. And you would hear Republicans in their speeches say Blue Lives Matter and that police are under attack, never really indicating that there were issues on the other side. I think it's fair to say that you're going to hear a different message here in the Democratic convention.
And also, one of the speakers at the Republican convention was Senator Ron Johnson, who is being challenged by Russ Feingold. Will Russ Feingold be taking the stage at the Democratic convention?
As far as we know, he will not. But that's what I would have told you about Senator Ron Johnson a few weeks ago. His campaign was saying he would not be at the Republican convention in Cleveland. And there he was. Not only was he there, he was speaking at the Republican convention in Cleveland. So for Ron Johnson, it was kind of this wholehearted embrace of, you know, Donald Trump, who is somebody he kind of wanted to keep his distance from, as Ron Johnson is trailed in the polls throughout the year. It may have been just a nod to the reality that they're facing as Republicans in Wisconsin, or that he's facing, that you're going to need people to come out and support Donald Trump if he's going to have a chance. in Wisconsin. I don't know if Russ Feingold faces that same calculus, because he wants to keep Clinton supporters and Sanders supporters happy and would rather not be here if things get a little bit ugly between them.
So, Sean, platform and rules votes begin today, taking care of some of the housekeeping before the event really gets rolling. Are you looking for any surprises there?
I think probably what's going to happen is that the platform and the rules that came out of committees here will be what stand, but I don't know. I mean, once it goes to the floor, there is, in theory, a chance for all the delegates who showed up to have a say on this stuff. And so you're going to have definitely a vocal contingent of Sanders supporters who want to push that platform a bit further to the left, especially on issues like trade, for example, a very firm stand against the Trans-Pacific Partnership and trade deals like those. When it comes to the rules, you're going to hear a vocal push, I think, by Sanders supporters to end superdelegates. That's something that was not supported in committee, and so they maybe have their work cut out for them, but I think you're going to hear them be very vocal on the floor to try to end those. Yeah. Whether or not that happens, or procedurally, how those things actually pass or fail here, I don't know. Typically, the party that's running the convention, I shouldn't say the party that's running the convention, but the national, the RNC or the DNC, they can use the rule book to their advantage when it comes to these votes. And if they want to table something that is get rid of it, they can.
Sean, before we let you go, let's bring in a caller. And Diana in Taylor is up. Hi, Diana.
Hi. I trust Hillary Clinton to put forth a more progressive administration than by far and away Trump or any of the Republicans. Republicans run a very good psychological warfare with putting forth fear and mistrust, and Democrats will stay home. If I may, very quickly, look at what happened in Britain, where the mostly young people who opposed Britain leaving the EU stayed home, and now they have to live with the results. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure. Thanks, Diana. So, Sean, it sounds like Diana is saying that, there can't be any sitting at home and assuming someone else is going to go out there and make sure it turns out well. Are you sensing that kind of energy on the ground in Philadelphia?
I'm definitely hearing that message from Democrats here, and I think you're going to hear that message over and over again. As far as her trusting Hillary Clinton to have a more progressive, more liberal platform than Trump or Republicans, just talking to a prominent Clinton supporter in Wisconsin, Heather Colburn, who's kind of organizing the delegate activities here on behalf of the Clinton campaign among the Wisconsin delegation. She said that Clinton has this rap for having moderate views, and that she's actually she thinks that that's not earned. That Hillary Clinton gets that reputation because Bill Clinton had a more moderate administration. That Hillary Clinton, if you look at votes she's taken, that she is actually to the left of her husband.
All right. Well, Sean, we'll let you go, and we'll look forward to hearing from you more later in the week.
All right. Thanks, Judith.
That was Sean Johnson, WPR's News Capital Bureau Chief. He is on the ground in Philadelphia this week for the Democratic National Convention, as he was last week in Cleveland for the GOP convention. And he will be on Central Time every day at 4 o'clock, Monday through Thursday this week. You can tune in to hear more from him there. Well, after just a very short break, we're going to continue talking about the Democratic National Convention with Ruth Conniff, editor-in-chief of the Progressive Magazine, and David Zwerdlich, editor of the Washington Post's Post Everything section. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Kathleen Dunn today. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Right now, we are continuing an extended edition of All Things Political, talking about the Democratic National Convention, which is kicking off today in Philadelphia, as we did last week for the GOP convention. We are taking an extended look at all things political. And joining us now from the convention is Ruth Conniff. She's editor-in-chief for the Progressive Magazine and a native of Madison, Wisconsin. Ruth, great to have you with us.
Good to be here.
And we're also pleased to have David Zwerdlich with us. He's the assistant editor of the Washington Post's Outlook and Post Everything sections. David, thanks so much for taking the time to be here today.
Thanks, Judith. Hey, Ruth.
Good to be here with you guys.
Well, Ruth, let's start with you. Many describe the RNC mood as kind of doom and gloom and a dark future ahead. What are you expecting the tone of the Democratic National Convention to be?
Well, you know, coming into the convention, it seemed pretty clear that the mood would be in stark contrast to the RNC. I mean, we just came from Cleveland, where we saw not only all those doom and gloom speeches, but a very, very divided party. I mean, a dramatic division with the Ted Cruz delegates who were outraged, frankly, by what they felt was mistreatment by the Trump people and by the institutional party. And so after covering that division, I sort of came here thinking that we would see a big show of unity and a big smiley face. And instead, we walked right into the W. Wasserman Schultz email scandal. And I just came from watching Bernie Sanders speak to delegates who cheered him wildly. And then as he pivoted to say, you know, we've got to defeat Donald Trump and we've got to elect Hillary Clinton, booed and overcame him with chants of "We want Bernie." So he had to struggle to regain control of the room to give the rest of his speech to his own supporters. So it's also going to be a bit of a lift for the Democratic Party to come out of this convention looking united, and there's a big rift going on here right now today.
So David Zwerdlich, what do we know about this email leak? WikiLeaks is the group that made it public. The timing of it, they could have released it any time between now and November. What do you think was the goal, and what do you think is going to be the fallout?
So there's a lot of reporting and theorizing on this, right? I mean, a lot of credible sources have said that they think it's sort of been fairly well established at this point that Russian hackers were responsible for the DNC leak. What the motivations are, or who leaked the information, or the timing, or if there's any ties to the Trump campaign, I think is still in the theorizing stage. But the timing seems not coincidental, but it also seems like Democrats need to brace themselves. Last night, the new interim DNC chair, Donna Brazile, was on CNN, and she was talking about the fact that, look, Democrats have to ready themselves for the possibility that more will be leaked out, right? That this isn't it. I tend to think, Judith, that despite the controversies that's been generated in the last 2 days, and I agree with Ruth that, like Republicans, Democrats have their hands full trying to get a unified party through a week-long convention. I tend to think that there's a lot more smoke than fire in the emails that have been released so far by the leakers, right? I mean, it looks very badly for former chair Debbie Wasserman Schultz. She had to resign. I think that probably had to happen to move the party forward. But, it represents a lack of judgment, but I don't see anything in there yet that constitutes, a breach of election law or campaign finance law. It just shows that, you know, she was sort of putting her thumb on the scales, or some of her staff were wanting to put their thumb on the scales for Senator Sanders. If there are more leaks to come, I think Democrats really do need to be wary about that. And then I will reserve judgment on all these, rumors about ties to Russia and the Trump campaign having ties to Russia. I just don't think enough information's in right now on that.
So the RNC theme, and certainly Donald Trump's theme that he has been hitting hard, is Make America Great Again. It seems like the Democrats are trying to say, hey, America's already great. Let's make it even greater. And the way to do that is to be united. Ruth, do you think that's going to be a possible tactic for them to take, given that there is this discord?
Well, without a doubt, people who are inclined to be progressive, to be Bernie Sanders supporters, who are considering whether or not to support Hillary Clinton after a very bitter primary campaign, are more inclined to believe that we should have a multicultural democracy and that, you know, we shouldn't sort of view immigrants and Black Lives Matter and this sort of host of others that the Trump that Trump and his other speakers at the convention painted as this grave threat to the world. I mean, I do think that that very dire picture he painted of America as a dark and violent place that's, you know, basically being consumed in fire and blood is not most people's everyday experience. And, you know, there's a lot of fear and a lot of anger. Those were the themes of the Republican convention. So I think absolutely here you see a much more relaxed multicultural group. You see people who are really proud of the first African-American president who's finishing up his second term. You know, you see culturally a very, very different outlook. And I think one that is that's more in line with the mainstream of American voters. However, you know, with the Bernie Sanders people and the establishment Democrat disconnect, I am really struck by how different it is moving back and forth between these groups. And the Sanders campaign was all about this political revolution that he described. And people took that very, very seriously. So whatever the ultimate conclusion is on the WikiLeaks, you know, whether it was the Russian government, whether it was something orchestrated by Trump, you know, kind of doesn't matter, because what it shows is that just as Sanders and the Sanders campaign and his supporters suspected, there is this establishment in the Democratic Party that never wanted him to succeed and that really did stack the deck against him and treat him with contempt. And so his supporters are they're grappling with how do they move forward, what their political agenda is, and that is this movement politics. It's Black Lives Matter, it's the fight for 15, it's universal health care, and you know, all of these things that they care about and that they want to continue to fight for. It's kind of a weak joint between that group of folks and the Hillary Clinton establishment Democratic Party. So I hear folks who are in the establishment Democratic Party say things like, I can't believe these people. What do they think they're doing? Don't they understand the stakes are high? They've got to stop. They've got to fall in line. And then I see the Sanders supporters who are much more grassroots activist types who have not been involved in electoral politics all their lives. And it's just not their party as they see it. This is about a movement. So there's a real disconnect with these two groups talking past each other. And it'll be interesting to see whether it's possible to create a united force out of them.
Yeah. So, Judith, can I just jump in on,
sure,
on what Ruth was saying? Because I largely agree with everything that Ruth just said, but let me just tweak both of those points, if I could. In terms of the deck being stacked, I think that's right. I think the emails suggest that strongly, and I think you didn't need the emails even to know that, as Ruth said, right? The party elites, the party establishment favored Secretary Clinton all along, really. The one thing that I would sort of, you know, put out there as a different way of looking at it, though, would be this idea that, it's not been clear to me exactly what Sanders and Sanders supporters would have expected going back to a year ago, right? In other words, yes, there is an expectation that the party will play by the rules, but I also think it would have been reasonable for, certainly for the political pros within the Sanders campaign, up to and including Senator Sanders, but even for a lot of supporters to understand that if you're explicitly saying one candidate is the candidate of the establishment, Secretary Clinton, and the other is the insurgent, Senator Sanders, that the establishment would be backing the establishment candidate. So even though I think it was, made complete sense that Sanders took his campaign all the way to the end, the idea that there's been some sort of that's being pushed, I think, by some of the hardest of the hardcore Sanders supporters that there's been a betrayal, I think maybe is a bridge too far for my analysis. Going back to Ruth's point about the Trump campaign and the message, the sort of dark dystopian message that everyone's talked about since last Thursday, I agree that that's what was offered in Trump's Thursday night speech, but I do think also, and Ruth, you may agree with this, I think that was what he wanted to get out. You know, there were 3 days of bad headlines for the Trump campaign. The plagiarism, Melania Trump plagiarizing Michelle Obama. There was the Ted Cruz snub of Donald Trump on Wednesday night, and then the following Saturday, Trump sort of going small and going petty and going back to Cruz, even though he was already the nominated Republican candidate. But Thursday night, they got that, you know, world is going to hell in a handbasket message out that they wanted to get out. And I think that it was effective for them. The CNN has a poll out today that shows Trump ahead of Clinton, 48-45 in a head-to-head, and it's because they have their core base of supporters who are receptive to that message.
We're talking with David Zwerdlich of The Washington Post and Ruth Conniff of The Progressive Magazine. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Kathleen Dunn on this extended edition of All Things Political. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Will you be watching the Democratic National Convention? And what are you hoping to see or hear? If you're a Republican who is not happy with Donald Trump as the Republican nominee, what would you need to hear from the Democrats to sway your vote? Or if you're an independent voter, which way are you leaning? Again, join us at 800-642-1234. Let's go to the phones, and Jim in Rice Lake is up. Hi, Jim.
Yeah, I appreciate the program. I just wanted to it's understandable that it was a bump for the Republicans from their convention. The Democrats will probably bump it back. But there are two factors that are historically, I think, of significance. One is, come November, we're going to have an unemployment rate of about 5%, which historically favors the incumbent party. And you're going to have an incumbent Democratic president with a favorability north of 50%, higher than either of the candidates. So I think those are factors that probably point towards Clinton. And another thing is, when the dissent within the Democratic Party is historical. We can never forget Will Rogers' famous quote, I'm not a member of any organized political party. I'm a Democrat. I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks for that call, Jim. Ruth, would you like to respond?
Sure, yeah. I mean, I think that's true. I think that there's less discipline historically in the Democratic Party. And, you know, being here in Philadelphia and seeing the protesters marching in the streets and, just the feeling of it. And you can't forget how remarkable the Bernie Sanders phenomenon was. I mean, his campaign, which was counted out when he first announced and really kind of laughed at, became such a huge force in American politics. And a lot of people are really energized by that. I would not want to have to herd all these cats. I mean, I think it is really,
right.
It's an interesting problem that people are faced with. I mean, for example, Hillary Clinton picking Tim Kaine as her vice presidential pick, which was very much embraced inside Washington as he's a great guy. He's beloved by his colleagues and friends. He's a, social justice Catholic. He just seemed like a great pick inside Washington. For the Bernie Sanders people, it was terrible. He supported fast track for the TPP. He's been, he's got Capital One in his district. He's talked about loosening some regulations on banks. And it felt like a slap to them. And, it's hard to get people to come inside when their whole message is that they're being excluded, that there's a rigged system, that there's a group of insiders who run the party. And then there are people who really genuinely live on the inside and really feel like it's time for all of us to be on the team and get together. And I think don't fully appreciate that every move that sort of confirms that inside nature of the Clinton campaign alienates a group of people whose whole reason for the energetic movement that they're behind is to say we've got to democratize elections and politics in the United States, and these are grassroots issues, and we've got to carry this forward. So it's a it's a difficult moment. I went to a press conference this morning for the Bernie Delegate Network. Norman Solomon and Jeff Cohen put together this email list of Bernie delegates to kind of poll them on different issues, including the VP nomination and the platform. And they were talking about, the reporters in the room, largely Washington reporters, were asking over and over again, when are these people going to fall in line behind Hillary? Are they really going to make a scene at the convention? Don't they understand how destructive that would be? And the response over and over again from the Bernie Delegate Network folks is, we're not controlling people. We're just polling them. People are going to decide to do what they want to do. And really, ultimately, it's up to the Hillary campaign to court the voters, because this grassroots movement is bigger than a particular candidate. Mm-hmm. So it's a, it's just a different way of viewing politics.
Yeah,
and I
agree.
And I think where they're coming out, with this idea of, one of the things, just to answer that Washington Reporter question, which sort of always rising to the top, they're talking about a safe state strategy so that people who live in states like Texas or New York or California, where it's a given that they're going to go blue or red, are able to vote for whomever they want. But if you're living in a swing state, you're going to vote for Hillary. I don't know that the Sanders delegates are going to buy it. I talked to some who are absolutely in tears after Bernie Sanders' speech. So it's interesting. I don't think anyone's going to totally control this.
Yeah, I agree with Ruth that it is on the Clinton campaign to court the Sanders supporters, and I'm not sure that they've fully done that. Again, even though I just got through saying that I think that describing the process as rigged may be a bridge too far, now that the Democrats are where they are, right, as Ruth says, the Clinton campaign, if they want to win the election, the general election, if they want Sanders supporters to migrate to them, and there is evidence that Sanders supporters are migrating to them. Pew has a poll out today showing that of the people that consistently backed Sanders in the primaries, 90% of them, according to this today's Pew release, say 90% of them are going to back Clinton. But to the extent that they've still got to get those people enthusiastic enough to turn out to vote in November, I have been one who has said that the Clinton campaign, by picking Kane, Ruth brought up Senator Kane, I'm not sure if that was everything they could do to court those Sanders voters.
The pick that would have courted the Sanders voters?
I think Senator Elizabeth Warren would have sent a much stronger signal, and obviously the Clinton campaign has their reasons for picking Senator Kane, but I think if they had chosen or even indicated that they were giving stronger consideration in the last week to Senator Warren, that would have been a stronger signal to Sanders voters that they were saying, look, we hear you, we know where the energy is on the left half of the Democratic Party, and that is the energy that we want to take in. Instead, they went with a guy who, look, checks all the boxes. Senator, governor, mayor, speaks fluent Spanish. Most people in both parties have kind things to say about him, gave a great speech on Saturday, but is clearly seen as in the Clinton sort of establishmentarian moderate mold and not someone like Senator Warren, who is seen as being where the energy of the party is. If I could just add one more thing about the caller's point about the fact that, yes, even though we're describing the race as very tight and with Donald Trump being Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton being within each other's sort of margin of error, even though President Obama has a over 50% approval rating, even though unemployment is down to 5%, even though the stock market is up 11,000 points since March of 2009, the people don't feel in poll after poll, they say they don't feel like the country is on the right track. President Obama has high approval, but the right track, wrong track numbers are frequently in the negative for President Obama. And that, I think, is still a drag on the Democratic ticket.
So, Ruth, do you think that Elizabeth Warren was even a possible choice, given that Hillary Clinton is going to be trying to pull disaffected Republican voters over? And so going to someone who is clearly to the left of her, wouldn't that have alienated a lot of those independent voters that see themselves as more centrist?
Not necessarily, because I think what you have here is not so much a left-right as a top-bottom spectrum. So Elizabeth Warren, you know, with her Consumer Financial Protection Bureau and, you know, inveighing against the big banks, really represents an energy among independents as well as Democrats, which says, you know, this is Bernie Sanders' message, massive inequality.
Right.
You know, and as David points out, the stock market's up, but how are you doing? You know, for a lot of Americans, the stock market being up is doing nothing for them. We've got this shrinking, you know, flatlining income, shrinking middle class, massive college debt. These are the lived everyday experiences of a lot of American voters. So I think that the Elizabeth Warren name was really exciting to a whole lot of people who are not necessarily reliable voters but are essential to Democrats, particularly young people. And I don't know that it was ever a realistic idea. Frankly, I think Elizabeth Warren likes being her own boss, and I think being the number two in a Hillary Clinton administration might have been really hard for her to accommodate. But, you know, I think there were other names, too. There's Tom Vilsack was out there for a while, Julian Castro. I mean, there were a variety of names of people besides Tim Kaine. And with Tim Kaine, you know, one of the things that the Democrats did in the platform, which has been touted as one of the most progressive, as the most progressive platform in Democratic Party history, is they stopped short of denouncing the TPP, even though Hillary Clinton herself has moved to that position under pressure from Sanders. Tim Kaine was a supporter of the TPP. Hillary came out with an almost comical announcement that she'd had a conversation with him, and now he was going to oppose the TPP as well. That just doesn't look like something solid. In the platform, they could have gone further, and they could have given more to the Sanders delegates and said, all right, we're gonna oppose the TPP as a party. And they could have entertained, they could have entertained Elizabeth Warren certainly, but they could have entertained a Vilsack or some other, a pro-labor VP. I mean, one of the things that I think is really interesting when you look at the Democratic Party over time is that it used to be that a centrist candidate needed to be balanced by a leftist vice president, right? Mm. So, that's why you had Hubert Humphrey. That's why Jimmy Carter felt like he had to pick Walter Mondale. It seems to only work in the other direction now. Can you imagine if Bernie Sanders were the nominee, the pressure he would be under to pick a centrist, sort of steady as she goes, Washington inside vice presidential candidate? And apparently Hillary Clinton felt no such pressure. She didn't feel like she had to find somebody from the progressive base. She felt like, we can win this thing with the establishment. And that's real, and it could be a problem for her. She might be right, but it could be a problem.
We're talking right now with Ruth Conniff of the Progressive Magazine and David Zwerdlich of the Washington Post on this extended edition of All Things Political, taking a look at the Democratic National Convention, which kicks off today in Philadelphia. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Kathleen Dunn. We will be back with our guests and your calls in just a moment on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, and we are talking all things political today, taking a look at the Democratic National Convention, which is kicking off right now in Philadelphia. Our guests are Ruth Conniff, editor-in-chief of the Progressive Magazine, and David Zwerdlich, editor of the Washington Post's Post Everything and Outlook sections. And let's go to the phones, and John in Shawano is up. Hi, John.
Oh, hi, guys. So are you glad that finally the election is less than 4 months away? What are you going to do after that? It's been a long one.
It has.
Yeah. So anyway, I called in a little while ago. I'm just turned 50 years old. I've been voting Democratic since 1984, when I was 18 years old. The original Clinton bill, it was the first time I actually voted for the winner. Now, it's not just young, inexperienced college students that felt the Bernie, felt the burn, but also older people, middle-aged people who have gone through the Clinton era and just see a typical politician, and that's it. Now, with this latest scandal, you're only paranoid if somebody's really watching you or really out to get you. And, I'm not being paranoid that way at all as far as, But let me, real quick, as far as super delegates on the Democratic side, the Republicans trying to remake their rules to do a no Trump. Back in the good old year 2000, it should have been Al Gore as president because he won the popular vote, but not the Electoral College. That is the way the game is played. My last point, if you guys could, I've been saying since before 2008, even though I voted for Barack, I was very happy with his hopey changey attitude, which didn't really come around. But it is really time for a viable third party.
Now, all right. So, John, I'm going to have you leave it there so we have time for Ruth and David to respond. So a lifelong Democrat, 50 years old, felt the burn and is thinking it's time for a third party. Ruth, is that something that you're hearing echoed?
Well, sure. I mean, Jill Stein, I think, is giving a speech right now. She's the Green Party candidate. There was a march past the convention center here, people who are supporting her. I mean, Ralph Nader, the high watermark of third-party campaigns in 2000, I think got less than 1% in the end. So we don't have a political system that makes it very easy to run a viable third-party candidacy. And I think what you saw with Bernie Sanders is that he thought about it. He was an independent. He was not a Democrat. He decided to run within the Democratic Party because it seemed like the only way to really get some traction and run a credible campaign. And I think what his supporters are looking to is an effort to take over the Democratic Party and turn it into a more progressive populist party.
And David, so John was saying that, not just the young people felt the burn, but those young voters are going to be pretty important for the Democrats, and were very critical for Obama to win. What does the Hillary Clinton campaign have to do to make sure that those young voters stick with her?
Yeah, and that was the challenge for Senator Sanders, and it's the challenge now for Secretary Clinton, right? President Obama in 08 and 12 put together this, cobbled together this coalition, young voters, educated, urban, white voters, women, people of color, unions, et cetera. And the challenge now is that Sanders has some of those voters, right? And then Clinton has others of those voters. And I think the conventional wisdom is that in the primaries, one thing that helped Clinton get over the top, whereas Sanders didn't quite make it over the top, was that in some of the larger, more delegate-rich states that had that were more diverse, Clinton did better, partly because she had such strong support among particularly African-American voters as well as Latino voters. As you get younger, it tended to skew more towards Sanders, regardless of ethnic group. To the caller's question, yes, absolutely. It is not just the youth vote, but I do see anecdotally, especially just from my own reporting, that when you talk to younger people of all different sort of stripes, there is much more affinity toward the message of Senator Sanders, the idea that a fundamental change is needed in the political system and in the Democratic Party. I do think there are some structural impediments to that. Not just being the sort of machinations within the Democratic Party that we've seen play out over the last 48 hours, but just in terms of the sort of narrow choices that frequently face incumbent presidents. You know, President Obama, John, the caller a minute ago pointed out that he liked President Obama's hopey, changey sort of, if I may quote Sarah Palin there, outlook when he was campaigning in 08, and then that didn't necessarily for a lot of people come to fruition. But the reality is that when someone actually gets into office, they wind up being constrained by the fact that they are essentially the head of state and head of government of a country of 350 million people, the largest economy, the largest military, etc. President Obama has governed very much down the middle, even if to many people he represented that progressive change when he was originally a candidate. I suspect that if Senator Sanders had managed to get into office, if even Donald Trump managed to get into office, they would be less revolutionary as they sort of frame themselves. To give an example, before the break, we were talking about TPP. When you have an issue like TPP, where both President Obama, Democratic standard bearer, and Paul Ryan, your Wisconsin congressman who is the Republican Speaker of the House, both supporting TPP and both supporting fast-track authority for the president, and the fact that now you have the Democratic nominee and the Democratic vice presidential nominee supporting, having at one point supported TPP, even though they've moved away from that in response to pressure from within the party. It's those kind of things that are going to be hard to put the genie back into the bottle for Democrats and progressives. I'm not saying it's impossible, and I suspect that even though Donald Trump has been the main person railing against TPP, were he elected in November, I do think it would be hard for him to put the genie back in the bottle because mm-hmm. there was bipartisan support for it in Congress. Again, these things tend to have a way of sort of narrowly going down the middle once you get past the election and into the practice of actually governing. A lot of other forces come to bear besides these sort of stalwarts in either party.
Ruth, I want to ask you to touch on another key demographic for Democrats, and that is African-American voters. First time in decades that voters will go to the polls without the full protections afforded under the Voting Rights Act. Is that likely to play a role?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. I mean, this is obviously a huge issue in Wisconsin. We're waiting to find out whether people are going to be able to vote or whether our incredibly restrictive new voting laws are going to be overturned in federal court. This is a very big concern. It's really whether young people, African Americans, anybody who doesn't have a driver's license is going to be able to cast a ballot. And, the Democrats really need to get people out. But, I would just say, responding to something that David was saying, is, there really has to be a drive to get people both, obviously able to vote, but also enthusiastic to vote.
Yes.
And I think this is where you've got a Clinton campaign that is hoping that African-American voters, Latino voters, and others are sort of scared in her direction. And Trump is pretty scary. So it's possible that enough people will come out and vote to avoid a Trump administration that Hillary can win on that. But it's, you know, historically been the case that really negative elections also have feature really low turnout. And that's what we're heading into in this general election campaign season. So unless Hillary Clinton and Tim Kaine can find a way to persuade people who were really energized and enthusiastic about the Sanders campaign that they're offering something, that there's a positive reason to vote for them, I think there's a really risky element to that strategy, that, you know, you want people to vote for you because you're not the other guy. It's, you know, it doesn't always turn out to be enough of a motivator.
Let's get to one more caller now. Ruth in Milton joins us. Hi, Ruth.
Hi. I wanted to express that Hillary Clinton's strong point is her longtime dedication supporting Democratic candidates up and down the ballot. You know, there's Congress, the congressional candidates, the senatorial candidates, and I think that with more experience, these younger voters, as they mature, will learn to appreciate this dedication to the party.
All right. Thanks for that call, Ruth. Go ahead, David.
Yeah, I was just going to jump in and say I think that's partly true, and then there are partly – I think it's an excellent point. I'm sorry. The caller's name was
Ruth.
Ruth. I think that she makes an excellent point that, right, as millennials – become, you know, go into their 30s and 40s, people tend to have a more, if you will, pragmatic view of party politics and the two-party system. On the other hand, I do think there is something different about the current cycle, if for no other reason than, you know, the issues that are plaguing different groups, like younger folks, like communities of color, like people in Rust Belt manufacturing jobs, are now sort of these entrenched issues that we don't see ourselves cycling out of, even if we're in theory coming out of a recession, right? So you have people who are college educated in urban areas, areas where there are a lot of service jobs, a lot of white collar jobs, doing actually fairly well. The recession has faded away for folks in those situations. In communities that used to be heavy on manufacturing, in communities of color, among people who don't have college degrees, we're in this sort of fixed, cemented cycle where people are not experiencing the economic opportunities that past generations did, that I'm Generation X, that Gen Xers did, that Civil Rights Generation did, that Baby Boomers did. And that's why I think people are going to feel more strongly that some fundamental change within the parties and within the two-party system are necessary, because they're not just seeing this sort of like, oh, we're out of a recession and things are fine now. They're not fine now.
Yeah, and I'd like to add to that as well. It may be that there are people who will grow into a more pragmatic view of politics. But there's something else going on here that I think is important to note, and that is that there is a movement politics that has finally found a candidate and sort of got its message onto a big mainstream national stage. But that movement is not just a bunch of immature people with sort of a utopian fantasy. It's the labor movement in the United States, which has been talking about NAFTA-like trade deals, in which corporations write the rules behind closed doors and are allowed to overcome national, state, and local laws and ordinances on the environment, on labor protection. It's really dramatically anti-democratic, these trade deals. There are a lot of pressures, and I agree with David. Like, you know, what do you do when you're president of the United States? You know, it's an empire. It's got this giant military. You've got, you know, tremendous forces working on you. I don't know if Bernie Sanders would be an effective president. I don't know. I kind of tend to believe he would not cave to lobbyist pressure. I mean, that was part of the strength of his fundraising with the $27 contributions. But those pressures are enormous. So corporations and banks are powerful, powerful entities in American politics, and we have a set of policies that benefits them and a whole political class that's sort of in cahoots with them. And what's happened is over time we've eroded the strength of the middle class and working people in this country to such a degree, and union membership is down so far, that there's not a whole lot of leverage on the other side, and people are at a breaking point. So you've got the movement against the Trans-Pacific Partnership and other NAFTA-like trade deals, because they're unfair and they hurt ordinary working people. You've got the fight for 15 because people are working full-time for starvation wages and living below the poverty line. You know, people have reached a breaking point.
And we're going to have to leave it there. Ruth, David, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks, guys.
Ruth Conniff is editor-in-chief of the Progressive Magazine, and David Zwerdlik is editor of the Washington Post's Post Everything and Outlook Sections. Thanks to KP Whaley and Scotty Myers for producing this hour, and to Cheryl Gasser and Dave Potraz for on-air production here in Madison. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in today for Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.